You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. It is the 27th of November, 2019. I think this is the second show that I've done with the new Radio Albion name, which I very much appreciate, and the new music. And the two selections that I picked, my two favorite Slavic pieces, you know, of them all, the beginning of Ivan the Terrible, which, you know, the very beginning of that and starts off the show, and at the end, Slavonic Dances. And that's Prokofiev and Dvorak, respectively. I need to ask again my friends to continue to support me financially. As difficult as it is for me to say, I should be regaining my health insurance in the 1st of January. I hope, and hot water, maybe around the same time. So many other expenses over the last few years have weighed on me. Tax issues I didn't know existed, all kinds of things. Medical expenses, and simply the research expenses, the way to function in this without assistance, without a university, without a think tank, without an organization of any kind. I rely on you guys, and I've said this a million times. I'll say it a million times again. You guys have made it possible for me to do something that all my professors said I couldn't do, and that was to function as an academic. As a scholar, as a researcher in this field, independently, without a university, without a think tank, without a government, without someone, some powerful institution backing me. I rely on you guys. And you guys have been absolutely wonderful, and I thank you, and you know who you are. And please, I ask you to continue to support me, and I continue to do this work. And I'll do this until the day I die, because I don't know how to do anything else. And what I do well is Russian Orthodox history, Russian Orthodox history, especially when it comes to monarchy and nationalism, which has been my creed since I was in college. And today I want to go to the basics. I was on a podcast a few nights ago, called The Myth of the 20th Century. And it's a group of guys, and I it was a great show. I like these, you know, almost like a round table experience. We dealt with the October Revolution specifically. And I've dealt with this, of course, in Soviet book. I've dealt with it to some extent in the Third Rome. Or at least the origins of it in the Third Rome, and many times in essays. But I want to deal with it in great detail today, because this is one of the most insidious things, one of the most insidious events in history. I have a book out on the last year, on the 100th anniversary of the murder of the royal family. It's a short book. I think it's like 70 pages. And, and by the way, before I forget, my friends at Russia Insider, and the staff there are helping me, put out reissues of two older books of mine with brand new covers, and they really look amazing. They're, essentially they're second editions. of my book on the foreign policy of mass society, my critique of the American military presence in the Islamic world, and these are both relatively brief, short books, my book on Latin American military dictators. I had a two-part series on this show back, I think, in the summer, where I did what no one else has done, as always. The military governments during the Cold War in Latin America have been assaulted and attacked in every way possible by historians and journalists, by conservatives and leftists alike, because the left has completely monopolized the studies and the information on Latin America. The Church of Rome backed the communists to a great extent, in Central America and South America especially, and this hasn't helped anything. The nonsense of the death squads and the oligarchs and all this, and the myths that if those of you who haven't heard those shows, the myth, of course, that the U.S. supported and backed and especially wanted those military coups and those military governments to stay in power, is exploded. It's nonsense. State Department documents show that that's not the case, and that these were somehow reactionary, that they somehow supported the power structure. And I try to explain to people that the way that these men understood themselves, and that's never done. And I talk about Pinochet, but he's one of many. There's so many. I only dealt with, five or six. You know, these you have to understand them the way they understood themselves. You can't assume when you look at a political topic that everyone wants power and everyone wants money as much as they can get. It's simply a false assumption. Military men are not politicians. Most of them don't want political power. They're not trained in that area. They want to be soldiers, and they know that the more politics they get into, the worse off the army is. In Latin America, as well as in Europe in the 1930s, Latin America in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the communist left, financed by the USSR in Cuba and by many private organizations and private capital in America, financed the various red movements throughout especially in the countryside. As always, they lied to the peasantry about their agenda. And I mention this because, the October Revolution, same thing. When the Bolsheviks set out their agenda for the average person to read, they lied. They laid something out using language in a conversational sense, but they're using it in a sense that only their insider organization understands. I'm going to talk about here the withering away of the state here in a minute, what that actually means. It has nothing to do with getting rid of government. The fact that they use words that we normally use, in translation or otherwise, doesn't mean that that's the sense that they're using these words. These military leaders usually were asked to take over. They didn't want political power. They had enough on their plate being a general. That's tough enough as it is. And it's always the same. The situation is always, in every country, in every coup, the civilian government has failed to deal with both the economic problem as well as the insurgency, and the two of them are connected. You had two major parties, both run by oligarchs. They're enriching themselves, they're dependent on their connection with the U.S., and therefore liberalism. They're called banana republics. They're weak states that mean that American corporations can go in and boss them around. The oligarchs in these countries are already committed to the two major parties. This is usually the case in almost every country. They have no interest in a military government because military governments don't need them. They don't need American capital, and they don't need local oligarchs. Because military men have their own sources of finance and their own sources of power. These military governments actually accomplished more in terms of social reform than what the leftists were promising. They actually were doing it. And whenever these military governments that are excoriated in the American press and American history books, when they were involved in giving land to the peasants, which they did on a regular basis in huge numbers, Batista did it in Cuba, Somoza did it in Nicaragua, the communists were usually there in union with the U.S. to destroy it. And the reason why these governments couldn't engage in the social reforms that they wanted to do is that the communists usually would try to blow things up. No one, and I mean no one, in English, has taken these guys as an ideological movement. These military leaders in Latin America in the 60s, 70s, and sometimes in the 80s, and taken them seriously as political figures. I have, finally. So that book is going to be reissued and available on Amazon. I'll have the link as soon as it comes out. And then the same goes for the Middle East and Islamic World book. And it's the same publishing I'm using with Amazon with my Ukrainian nationalism. And this will give these books a far broader reach. And as always, I want to thank Russia Insider for doing this to me. They've come out of nowhere and asked to do it. They run a lot of my articles, and which of course they're I have no problem with that, and they're always well received, and they're doing this for me, and it's a wonderful thing. These books look amazing. So I mentioned in the communists, the leftists, wherever they go throughout planet Earth, they lie about what they want to do. This is always the case. They're never honest. It comes down to the fact that oligarchy and monarchy are the only two choices politically that you could possibly have. I know in the Old Testament you had the era of judges, which was a very, very unstable compromise. That is not a permanent solution. It was done, for example, the great Gideon. But that was, that's very informal. A military or royal central leadership is based on the common good. It doesn't matter what the central force is, so long as it's based on some traditional authority. And the monarch is the obvious, candidate for that. And then, of course, the opposite is liberal democracy, Marxist socialism, and that is the rule of the wealthy. A republic, as a form of government, I'm working on a paper on the Anti-Federalists, my favorite American topic, because, the American Founding Fathers were at war with each other. The American Founding Fathers were not a unified group. You can't talk about them as a unified group. It's a sign of illiteracy to talk about them as a unified group, unless, of course, you're talking about the Federalists. Well, the Federalists were, generally speaking, oligarchs. The Anti-Federalists and Shades Rebellion and Freed Rebellion and the Whiskey Rebellion that fed on their ideas and generated their ideas to maintain the Articles of Confederation were wars of the backcountry against urban oligarchy. These were class wars. The left, bizarrely, has tried to claim these rebellions as their own. Again, this is something that leftists do. They're very, very dishonest in that respect. There's nothing liberal about Shays' Rebellion, just like there's nothing Bolshevik about Pugachev. The left always lies about their agenda. They can't come out and say, no oligarch can come out and say, I'm a rich guy, I'm going to plunder you, and so just shut up and let me do it. No, they have to create a party, a movement, write a constitution, say how wonderful they are, and use all kinds of universal phrases, human rights and equality and the rule of law. Rule of law is one of my favorite stupid phrases. Rule of whose law? Who passes it? Who does it benefit? Rule of law. Well, the October Revolution is one of these things. Remember, there's two revolutions here, 1917, February and October. Simply put, February was the removal of Tsar Nicholas, and October is the slow, the takeover of the government buildings in St. Petersburg by the by the Bolsheviks. And you really have, I've termed four leftist revolutions of the early 20th century in Russia. The first is the failed revolution of 1905. The second is the February. The third is October. And the fourth is the murder of Tsar Nicholas. You might want to mention maybe there's a fifth in the 19th century, the Decembrist revolt, but that didn't go anywhere and that lasted a very short time. But all of those had one thing in common. That it was a means whereby oligarchy was able to take power. And of course, the hated enemy was that which forced them to serve the common good, and that was a monarchy. Central landed authority based on religious tradition. Now, the October Revolution had its slogan, all power to the Soviets. I mean, you know, you read history books, you know, the guys who get to teach in universities, you know, I tell you, they take these guys seriously. All power to the Soviets. Well, the Soviet's kind of a strange word. It's not the commune. It's almost a neologism that the Bolsheviks had this as a community, not really, it's a collective that they're creating. It's completely artificial. All power to it. As if the Bolsheviks had any interest in elections or any kind of free choice in the matter. If you believe that you have the key to history and you believe that you are the voice of reason and history itself, well then, you know, elections are out of the question, or any kind of normal free thinking. These councils were not organic. They were top-down, artificial creations of the Bolshevik Party. But the splits in the far left, at the very end of World War I, the left socialist revolutionaries continued to support the war. There still was a strong faction in the ruling class that wanted the war to continue. The disastrous, meaningless World War I, that, as you all know, had one purpose, and that was to save the British Empire from being challenged by the dual attack of Germany and Russia. But the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk was in 1918, was one of the reasons for the schism, where so much of the more advanced industrial centers of Russia were given over to others in exchange, and they had to pay an indemnity. It's almost like a weaker version of Versailles that Lenin was willing to sign. There's a great book out if you read Russian, Mikhail Nazarov, the leader of the Third Rome, published by Russian Idea, which is the Union of the Russian People, in 2005. And it's one of the best books on the religious understanding of the October Revolution, everything that came around it. And the left, you know, the far left, of course, is romanticized beyond all reason by journalists and academics and even, you know, conservatives who are anti-Russian, who don't understand monarchy, who see it as this, some, you know, this feudal idea, you know, not really knowing what feudalism is. The left is seen as obviously correct. And you had a tradition, and this is all very, very Jewish, very urban, the so-called narodniks, or the populace, going to the people in the abstract. And people like Nazarov, you know, make the point that they don't really, these guys don't know the first thing about how ordinary people function. And certainly not agricultural people. The one thing Jews don't know is agriculture. The early Russian Social Democratic Labor Party in 1898, the first conference in Minsk, the leadership was Vidorchik, Katz, Kremer, Mutnik, Pershevich, Zhukovsky, Edelman, Kremer, Edelman again with an A, Radchenko, you know, very non-Russian names you see everywhere. And Lenin hated the idea if anyone would even talk about the reliance on the so-called natural communal idea of the Russian people. Lenin saw himself as conquering Russia. That's what he said. These men hated Russia. They hated all nations. And they would use national movements if it served their goals. And the idea that the Narodnik's idea was, I mean, to put it very simply, is that socialism can be reached if we rely on traditional communal structures that I've been talking about for decades, and that these can be transformed into secular materialist servants of the regime. But even that was too much of a concession to tradition in Lenin's mind. The Soviets, the collectives, had nothing to do with communes, had nothing to do with any kind of actual community. The collectives that the Soviets created were explicitly and in a very, very deliberate way, artificial. They were imposed on people and put together overwhelmingly by urban Jews and others who had not only no idea of how a farm worked, but hated it and loathed it. So the big difference between the social democrats and the party of socialist revolutionaries, again, this split was led by Natanson, Guts, Gershuni, these people who looked at the peasantry as a revolutionary class. You know, it's telling people that, you know, don't worry, we'll make them secular materialist Westerners here soon, but let's work with them and treat them as equals and use them that way. Lenin said, no, we're at war with these people. The Soviet government fully understood itself as an enemy of Russia. They served a different agenda, whether it be the Enlightenment, secularism, Judaism, whatever it might be. They worked with the peasantry, so to speak, only because it was the bulk of the population. But the Narodniks also developed an almost exclusively Jewish movement, the Combat Organization, that were engaged in terrorist bombing throughout Russia in the beginning of the 20th century. And it's from this group, the Second Congress of the RSDLP in Brussels and then in London, split into two factions, that was the Bolshevik and Menshevik split. And the Jewish Bund, sort of the midwife of that schism. And essentially it was two factions of Jews. It was, you know, Trotsky and Eiffelbaum on the one hand, and Bernstein, not Trotsky, the other Bernstein, on the other side. So both sides of this, both the Narodnik and the Bolshevik were Judaic. At least at their head, and they had Jewish biases, the contempt for agriculture, their obsession with mechanization, that the city can be imposed on the countryside, and the entire country could be turned into one big factory. How they were going to go about that were two very different things. They agreed on far more than they disagreed. Now, one of the things that this schism showed is that Lenin, unlike his opponents on the far left, engaged in the policy of what we call defeatism. It means that Lenin was going to work for the defeat of the Russian Empire by force of arms, whether it be by the British or the Japanese or the Germans or whoever. When Jacob Schiff started to build the Japanese Navy to attack Russian installations in the Far East, it was the same money that went to finance Jewish self-defense groups in places like Odessa, which were the so-called the fighting between the self-defense groups and the Black Hundreds were the so-called pogroms, where far more non-Jews were killed than Jews. But Lenin made it very clear that the defeat of the army, the Russian army in combat, was absolutely necessary for his agenda to be promoted, and that we need to do everything we can to sabotage the war effort in every way. There were some on the left who wouldn't do this. The Mensheviks were not going to go that far. Of course, the other thing that the Bolsheviks were willing to do is begin the string of bank robbery, which is kind of ironic. It's just really, you know, being financed by the banks in just a different way, more direct than taking the money from Kuhn Loeb. But people forget the massive number of terrorist attacks. There were 2 or 3 a week at the beginning of the 20th century in Russia that were completely covered over in the general press. The right-wing press in the Russian Empire at the time was surprisingly weak. So the bank robbing organizations, the two big ones were the Helsingfors in 1906 and Tiflis in 1907. Yeah, several dozen people were killed in these. They're more than just robberies. They were actual battles. And of course, you know, the Bolsheviks were also willing to take money from stupid liberals. People like millionaires like M.I. Tereshchenko became part of the provisional government. N.P. Schmidt, a Russian citizen who, due to a sexual relationship with Andreeva, who was living with Gorky, put in his will 280,000 rubles and then mysteriously committed suicide right afterwards. The industrialist Morozov, who financed the 1905 revolution, also, after putting the Bolsheviks in his will, suddenly committed suicide abroad. And all of his money went to the Social Democratic Party. And then, of course, the Masonic sects. P.P. Rybushinsky was the leader of the Masonic. He published the Morning of Russia, which is the Masonic newspaper. And Konovalov, also a very wealthy industrialist, who then soon was going to be a member of the provisional government. So the far left was financed exclusively by the super wealthy, who saw in the Bolsheviks and even their opponents on the far left, materialists, secularists, centralizers, who wanted to destroy any kind of spiritual sense, create an industrial empire with drones as workers. A third part of the agenda was the notion of the prison of peoples idea. All of a sudden, Lenin decided he's going to be a nationalist for everyone but Russia. Now, of course, they hated nations. They dedicated themselves fanatically to the destruction of nationalism, unless they could use it. The defeatist idea meant that they need to support nationalist movements, whether it be in Finland or Poland or Ukraine, against the Russian Empire. Again, they pretended to care about national cultures only when it was in their interest. The explicit goal was the merging of all nations. But supporting the separatist movements, even in and of themselves, if they had a certain legitimacy, it doesn't matter. They were willing to control them, support them, and maybe bring them to an understanding of what Bolshevism was, slowly but surely. So Lenin says in his paper in 1914 on the right of nations to self-determination, and this is the double-mindedness here. He says, the state of affairs, the task of the proletariat of Russia, it's a two-sided task. We need a struggle for self-determination of nationalities and a struggle against all nationalism of, first of all, the great Russian nationalism. So we're going to be in favor of and against nationalism at the same time. The difference is, of course, the one nationalism that we're going to fight tooth and nail, anything having to do with orthodoxy, anything having to do with Russia. They will support, however, other forms of nationalism. The Ukrainian one got a little bit they're too big for Jewish interests. And one of the bizarre things that Lenin continued to say and Trotsky and these other Jews is the idea that nationalism somehow was a petite bourgeois idea. And he knew full well he's taking money from these people. He knows full well that the bourgeoisie despise nationalism. They are internationalists by their very structure. The reason that, one of the big reasons that Lenin and Trotsky hated the Narodniks, the so-called populists, was that capitalism was necessary to destroy national cultures. Marx said this, Engels said this, Lenin said this. You can't skip liberal capitalism on the way to socialism. You need it. Karl Marx made it clear over and over again, as did Engels, that liberal capitalism and free trade is necessary, are necessary, so that nations and distinctiveness, different ethnic groups, can be broken down through free trade. He said it over and over again. That's why capitalism was so important to Marxism. You have to go through that stage, not just to build up productive capacity, but also to destroy any kind of communal identity. What's put into place is not, of course, communal at all. It's collective. And Lenin, when World War I broke out, Lenin threw a fit when far leftists began supporting their nations, especially in the West, because they were fighting Russia. Remember, despite the fact that France and Britain were technically on the same side as Russia, they were Russia's enemies. Britain far more than France. Britain was deliberately creating a situation using the Balkans and the Austrian Empire to get Berlin and Petersburg to start shooting each other. That was their only chance of winning this fight, because Germany and Russia were growing way too fast, and they were way too big. Their populations were exploding. They couldn't allow this, not to mention they both had very strong states with a state control over the currency, which was very much focused on gold. But when the war broke out, you had this debate on the far left. This war is good for us because these people are killing each other, because they're going into debt, because maybe we could overthrow these governments. Lenin, looking only at the Russian case, said, no, we need to support the enemies of Russia to bring down the monarchy. So any support of the war effort in the Russian Empire was absolutely shut down by the Bolsheviks at every turn, and it meant that they became a much smaller organization. And in 1914, Lenin said, the task of Russian social democracy is in particular, first of all, the merciless and unconditional struggle against great Russian and Tsarist monarchist chauvinistic, the sophisticated defense of it by Russian liberals, cadets, part of the Narodniks, and other bourgeois parties. The least evil would be the defeat of the royal monarchy with its troops. And it's bizarre the mental gymnastics he has to go through to get there. The cadets, the Russian liberals, they despised the monarchy. And yet Lenin, in his hysteria, claimed that they were doing the monarch's bidding by supporting the war effort. They, of course, made a very clear distinction. And Lenin's slogan was the transformation of the imperialist war into a civil one. Now, he's right about one thing. This was not a war of nations. Nationalism had absolutely nothing to do with World War I, absolutely nothing, because the entities that fought one another in the war were empires. Those are the opposite of nations. Empires are usually suppressing nations in one way or another. So you have professors talking about nationalism as a cause of World War I, and you have to laugh at them. These guys are repressing, these guys are at war with nationalism all over the world. It's imperialism. That's what was fighting. This is one thing that at least but Lenin, you know, and again, in his over-emotional, hysterical approach to these things, and Trotsky was even worse, that he couldn't make a distinction between this war as benefiting imperialism versus benefiting nationalism. If there was a small chance that Russia was going to be victorious in this war, or at least have a good showing, he knew that his movement was finished. They needed a war. They needed a lost war. That's why the Vietnam War was so important to the 1960s radicals. Jerry Rubin himself said, without Vietnam, there is no hippie movement. There is no leftist takeover of America. The February Revolution, the Bolsheviks had nothing to do with this. Lenin didn't think that there would be any revolution in 1917. He said maybe his children would see it, but he would never see it. He was aware of the weakness of his movement because of these issues. And he really saw the provisional government as a conspiracy of the Anglo-French imperialists, which, by the way, isn't entirely wrong in this case. And Zinoviev, another Jewish leader of the Bolshevik Party, said Lenin did not play a decisive role in the February Revolution and could not do it. The working class, which means he means the party, was then on the defensive. Again, they refer to workers and the working class and proletariat as identical with their movement. The fact that none of these guys had any connection with labor, that these guys were all from wealthy Jewish families, almost to a man, has no bearing on this. They believe that they are the voice of the working man, but again, the idea of the working man is that of the creator of the new society. That's what the work is, not working in a factory. That's a problem with this kind of history, is that they're using language in a way that they know the meaning of these terms, but the average person does not. It's designed to deceive. So then when the provisional government takes over, when essentially the military overthrew Tsar Nicholas, he did not resign from office. He did not write that resignation letter. I talked about that in the show at some length. The so-called white government, or their provisional government, was based on a Masonic sect, which Kerensky belonged. And people like Skoblev, Duma factions, everything else. Lenin condemned this as the illegal offspring of the Duma. And at least he was right in this sense, that international capital was involved in the creation of the provisional government. But because of how unstable it was, its lack of any unifying ideology, the fact that it was this crazy coalition of every kind of group you could imagine, and that was the case with the white armies that defended it, the Western capitalists began to realize that it had no future. So this provisional government lost strength very quickly, especially as World War I was winding down. The Germans, as you know, made sure that these exiled revolutionaries were brought back into Russia. They knew that the defeatist ideology that Lenin was promoting was good for Germany. Trotsky was detained in March 21st in Halifax, Canada. And he was sailing to Russia with a small army of revolutionaries with Wall Street money. I mean, this was, Schiff made no bones about this. The Canadian border guards arrested him, not because he was some revolutionary, they knew he was revolutionary, but he might be working for the Germans. That was his big crime. He was given an American passport, and the Schiff family intervened on his behalf. And he was released, and he arrived in Russia in May. But Lenin thought that the chaos of the provisional government was perfect for what he was going to do. He said, we're going to use the freedom that he has to establish what he called the Third International. Weak governments are what these guys need. A strong military government with an orthodox backing or a monarchy, that's something that he couldn't deal with. They were going to be defeated. With a strong pro-labor agenda, it had been done under Alexander III, that they couldn't handle. That they would have to fight with every bone in their body. But the white government, the provisional government, was so weak, purely based on this very weak capitalist Masonic idea. And it was a transitional state. Provisional means provisioning, for something else to happen. Officially, it was the, constituent assembly elections. But of course, we all knew what it really meant. But of course, all power to the Soviets meant all power to him and absolutely at war with anything the provisional government did. So the civil war between whites and reds was certainly not between right and left. It was two factions of the left. Now that doesn't mean that there weren't very good right wingers in the white armies. There were many of them. That was just an alliance of convenience. What hasn't been dealt with, I can't do this now, but the Orthodox Church, almost to a man, supported the Masonic Revolution in February. That has not been dealt with yet. The overthrow of the monarchy was welcomed by the church with only a handful of exceptions. Now, actually, I think I have dealt with that in the last year with the Tsar Nicholas thing. Only a handful of bishops in the synod rejected the white government. Overwhelmingly, they supported it, and they welcomed the overthrow of Tsar Nicholas. Only a handful of bishops stood for him. We talk about the betrayal of Sergius, 1927, which was far harsher. You know, because it's so blatant, supporting the Soviet government, despite the conditions he was in. Now, in this case, it's an open betrayal of the monarchy and of the church on which it's based. They thought that the white government, the Masonic government, was a gift from God, and that they commanded their people to pray for it. This comes from God. This is a good, and so that a lot of these people then support the Soviet government later, a few years later, is no surprise. So slowly but surely, Lenin and Trotsky were able to win this because of the money that they had. No one had the cash flowing in that Lenin did. It's because of Trotsky's Jewish connections. He was able to get Schiff to back him because he and he alone had the ruthlessness and the agenda and the ability to have a simple, easy to understand, purely centralized, purely state-centered ideology. No one else came close to that. There was no real organized monarchist movement. And if it was, there were too many factions. The Union of the Russian People had fallen to pieces. But under the provisional government, the army was purged constantly. It was disappearing. Trotsky's forces, I mean, Lenin's order number one, the so-called soldiers' committees, the Bolshevik military units that they were democratizing the army, he said. The point being to make the army loyal to him. Now, they didn't say this is what, you know, they were Bolsheviks in the sense we know it. Lenin was lying about his agenda and was claiming that the simple soldiers is better than the officer. And so he was provoking all this insubordination with these soldiers' committees. Part of the reason for Lenin's success, the money that he had, he was propagandizing soldiers and sailors, saying that the war is over, that you're being betrayed. If you leave the front now, you can go and claim the land is yours personally, that the Tsar has ordered you to do this. And they did all kinds of tricks to do this. Given the exhaustion of the forces, that this war was going nowhere, even though Russia had made great gains, we're talking about 1918 here. But Lenin said, you know, peace without annexations and indemnities. In other words, they were going to let their opponents occupy huge chunks of Russia. And this was the split within the left. Once the Kornilov coup failed, an attempt for Kornilov to stop the chaos in St. Petersburg and overthrow Kerensky, the army began to fall apart. And Trotsky, with tons of money and mercenaries from all over the place, slowly began to rebuild it using these committees. And what you began to see is it wasn't that peasants were reclaiming land. They were the landowners. It was worse than that, because Lenin opened the prisons. People forget about this. When he opened the prisons, he immediately mobilized these people. Many were mentally ill. I mean, these were actual criminals. And he used them to attack the houses of the merchant classes, who were opponents of theirs, the old aristocracy, royal houses, of course, you know, churches and monasteries, and they were smashing and destroying everything. They destroyed countless numbers of absolutely priceless artifacts in this orgy prior to the takeover of the Bolsheviks that were destroying, you know, everything they could get their hands on. That's a great writer like Stepun once said, who was there at the time. He said, no, Lenin knows exactly what he's doing. F. Stepun made it clear that Lenin is deliberately releasing this frenzy that's pent up with these people and bringing these criminals out of the institutions, because this is how he was rewarding his followers. And he's getting tons of money from the Germans. German POWs by the thousands were being mobilized by Lenin. They had international forces behind them. They were creating the structure of a totalitarian state, and they were doing it very, very quickly. But they only had a handful of people. Therefore, it had to have been foreign forces. It had to have been foreign money, mercenaries, the use of POWs, the use of criminals, and decommissioned soldiers that were told something completely different from the actual agenda that the Reds had. And any time, and one of those bizarre things at the time, is when Lenin was challenged, or Trotsky was challenged, saying, "This, you're getting money from the Germans, this is a German intelligence operation," he would say, "This is blood libel. This is a new Belus case." Belus, of course, is the ritual murder in Ukraine that kind of, you know, paralyzed the Russian judiciary in the early 20th century. Well, no one said anything about the Jews, but his immediate reaction was, this is a pogrom. This is a new Belus case. And all anyone would say is that you guys are taking money from the Germans. It was an obvious admission that this is fully a Jewish movement. With all this, as I said before, the failure of the Kornilov's coup. Some claim that Kerensky set this up, but Kerensky created this. You know, whether he set Kornilov up or not, Kornilov was going to restore the honor of Great Russia because the country was falling to pieces. On August 27th, he came to the capital. And he was going to put his, you know, legitimate order on this system. And he declared, of course, Kornilov a traitor. His ally Krumov, General Krumov, committed suicide. And the country was under the impression that this was this massive destruction of military discipline. And the beneficiaries of this were the Petrograd Soviet. And for the first time, the 1st of September, the Bolsheviks had a majority on these committees in St. Petersburg. And Lenin at the time, by the way, is hiding in Finland. And his articles, Bolsheviks Must Take Power, Marxism and Rebellion, etc. This is, you know, he's still talking about the possibility now of taking over in a full uprising. However, his people were saying, we don't have the men. Yes, Kornilov was defeated. The whites are in trouble. But the constant warfare is draining on the population. Now, these soldiers' committees that I mentioned before were slowly being organized by Trotsky with all of these foreign elements. What a lot of people didn't know is that Trotsky was going back and forth from New York to the U.S. New York, Canada, Britain, and then Russia, bringing men and tons of money, building up the so-called Revolutionary Military Committee. And the Second Congress of the Soviets was being called, and this was the pretext was the armed force necessary to secure it, to make sure that there was no attacks on it, no more Kornilovs that might break it up. That bodyguard, that military force that Trotsky had organized was probably the only disciplined force in the city at the time. And this is what took over. And that was the coup that we call the October Revolution. This was the deceit of Trotsky. And Stalin made it very clear in Pravda. He said, all work on the practical organizing of the uprising took place under the direct supervision of Trotsky. Now, later, he would deny this, But at the time, it was very clear Lenin and Trotsky, Stalin were of one mind, as they always were. There were only a few thousand Bolshevik men in the capital, but there were no government troops on the streets. But his men were disciplined. They occupied the stations, bridges, telegraphs, you know, everything, power stations, and they appeared to be stronger than they were. They had the money. They had international backing. They had German POWs. They had mercenaries. They had guys just out of prison. And they appeared to be more, because they were able to secure, Trotsky was a talented leader in a military sense, even though he had no military background. And the divided white forces in the provisional state, but there wasn't even this uprising didn't even happen. The so-called winter assault wasn't even necessary. Six people died total. The Revolutionary Military Committee arrested on October 26, at 2 a.m. They arrested the provisional ministers and declared themselves, you know, and this is when, of course, they plundered. They plundered all the museums. They went to all the churches. They went to all of these beautiful places, and they smashed icons and paintings, and they'd smear feces on really just awful. It was an orgy. Kerensky had created the female battalions, the shock troops, under ML Bukhareva. And they actually were, it's an interesting story. They were these all female units. Didn't see much action, but they were to show, they were kind of shame men into keeping up the war effort. And they were actually being used to guard, key points in the capital during this period of time. And, the Reds didn't take them very seriously. And in this orgy of destruction, they took these women and they did, very awful things to them. The so-called, female shock troops, sometimes they call them death brigades, were organized by all female, organized by, they saw some action at Kerevo, with some, you know, in July 1917, they did see some action. It was a revolutionary army, you know, women in combat. This was already a thing in Russia in 1917. There were two platoons in the Petrograd Military District, and the Foundry Bridges in the Nikolaev, area. And the Soviet sailors, actually Marines, destroyed them and disarmed them. And, the later commission, of course, showed that they were raped, en masse. And, several of these women later, committed suicide. So that was how the Reds took over. That was the October Revolution. And Lenin, as Stepunin and even Trotsky said, knew how to strategically allow for the explosion of the passions when he let these criminals and these Red Guards go through all the beautiful homes and museums and art galleries and churches and just rip everything to shreds. They didn't understand it. And it just shows, you know, the Jewishness of it all, because this was all, you know, Gentile artifact. And it's just a very bizarre historical fact that no one thought this would work. But the provisional government had lost all control of the power centers of the country, and the old expression developed that power was simply dropped by the whites, and the Bolsheviks picked it up. But the Red program, this is Lenin's leaflet that he would drop on, you know, areas. To all workers, soldiers, and peasants, the Soviet authority will at once propose a democratic peace to all nations and an immediate armistice on all fronts. He's talking about the World War I, of course. It'll safeguard the transfer without compensation of all land, landlord, imperial, and monastery to the peasants' committees. It will defend soldiers' rights, introducing complete democratization of the army. It will establish worker control over industry. It will ensure the convocation of the Constituent Assembly on the date set. It will supply the cities with bread and the villages with articles of first necessity. And it will secure to all nationalities inhabiting Russia the right of self-determination. Long live the revolution. That was a proclamation just prior to the October coup. Now you read this thing and The deceit that he packed into these few words is actually pretty impressive. And just off the top of my head, I have 15 ridiculous contradictions here. He addresses it to workers, soldiers, and peasants, number one. He knows the peasants hated him. He knows that he had no chance of winning them over. So addressing them as if they're part of the coalition was a joke. Number two, he's saying that the Soviets already have taken over, and they're going to convince all the other combatants in the war to lay down their arms. Number three, what is a democratic peace? It sounds good, but he doesn't say what that is. And how could the Bolsheviks, who hadn't taken over much of anything yet, a few government buildings in Petersburg, tell the governments of all of Europe that we're going to lay down their arms and have a democratic peace? Four, the transfer of land was to peasant committees, not peasants. Number five, 95% of all land was in the hands of peasants anyway. But what they were doing was destroying the actual communal society that had served them for so long and substituting their own collectives. Number six, monastic land and imperial lands. These were minimal. Monastic lands were almost non-existent. Seven, no Red Army guy ever believed in democratization. What they meant by democracy, what they always meant, was the rule of the party in every layer of the officer corps. Number eight, they rejected all worker control over industry. And even if they didn't, no one thought that workers, after everything that they had just gone through, were capable of taking over the industry of this massive society. Number nine, they had no intention of convoking the constituent assembly at any level. 10, they're implying that they can control the food supply. They could guarantee elections. Well, that's true or not, doesn't matter, but the concept is, we control the food, we control everything. 11, how were the Reds in total control of all requisitioning at this point? 12, the urban Jewish oligarchs took over the country at the time, they had no idea what the first necessities of a village were. These are nonsensical words. 13, it implied that all economic power was already in their hands. 14, they make reference to nationalism here, which, as I said, is a ridiculous joke. And the last thing they say, 15, long live the revolution. That doesn't make any sense. The revolution should be short. It shouldn't live long. It should be brief. So once it's over, the new government can then take over and start ruling. No. Chaos had to always be a part of Russian society. But from February to October 1917, the number of party members went from 5,000 to 350,000. All of a sudden, 50 newspapers were suddenly published in the cities. How? Especially when people didn't think that he had a lot of support, that he didn't have that many people, which is true. And of course, you know, the Soviet press later on said, oh, Lenin can express the aspirations of the masses. And phrases like that, of course, were mystifications, propaganda. No, it all comes from money. The Bolshevik Party, every office in that organization was paid. Committee members of the Bolshevik Party received a salary between 10 and 100 times that of a Russian officer or police officer at the time. Their Red Guards were paid and paid very, very well. Every office and the Bolshevik Party was paid. That meant they were getting mercenary guys with absolutely no moral scruple whatsoever. And you add that to the war, the chaos of the white society, the lack of ideology on their side, and of course the German Foreign Ministry, Kuhlmann, State Secretary of the German Foreign Ministry, said in 1917, he said, without our constant support, the Bolshevik movement would never have achieved such vast influence as it has now. Now there's every indication that it's going to continue to grow. Then he said again later in the year, he said, only when the Bolsheviks receive the constant flow of money from us through various channels under various names, they're able to strengthen their main body, which is Pravda, conduct energetic propaganda, and significantly expand, at first, the small base of their party. So September 1917, the Secretary of the Foreign Affairs, Kuhlman, is saying it's because of this massive amount of money that the Bolsheviks were getting from abroad is the reason why they did so well. Their propaganda, taking over newspaper after newspaper, mobilizing mercenaries, this is what they did. So as everything else is falling apart, as every other force in society seems to be in chaos, this fanatical Jewish group with they had Gentile members, of course, and they didn't, you know, the Jewish part of it was disguised by changing their names and everything else. They were the only ones who had a disciplined army, disciplined corps of fighters, paid positions, regular salaries, regular training, mercenary. They had it all, and they had a firm, simple ideology. I just read to you here, stupid though it was, that every word in that proclamation is idiotic. In a few words, just off the top of my head, I found 15 deliberate deceits and contradictions in there. And if that's not enough, when you say German money, or the Germans financed the Bolsheviks, those were loans to Germans from Jewish banks in the USA. It's not like the German government, you know, wrote checks to these people. It was the connections that Trotsky had and so many others had with the banks in New York City via Germany. Kuhlman himself said, only when Bolsheviks received what I just said, the constant flow of money through various channels and under various names. That's strange. He didn't say that we were giving them the money. It was through us that they got the money. But in August 1917, even before the October Revolution, a group of bankers arrived in Russia under the guise of the American Red Cross mission. And it was the Red Cross that, I don't know if they knew it or not, that served as the physical go-between among New York, Germany, and St. Petersburg. And that became the common source of financing. And you know what? Even the German money that they did receive, they repaid. Because after Versailles, the Bolsheviks continued to supply Germany with what they needed during their worst times. And so much of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was a way to sort of, you know, pay back the German support of the Red Movement. And even Trotsky had mentioned this, you know, that this was, you know, this was the connection that they had made with Germany, that once they had supported the Reds, they kept Germany alive. For the sake of revolution, of course, but they supplied the Weimar government with what it needed to function, even for the small little bit it did. So the Reds were financed by Germany, Wall Street bankers, again, as well as the requisitions of this disciplined force from around the country. And, you know, the director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, W.B. Thompson, in a memorandum to Lloyd George, December 1917, he said, the greatest military trophy the world has ever known is the Russian market. This gigantic, not just the Russian market itself, with millions and millions of people, but the access to Central Asia and the Far East, India especially. This is where the British, this was the ultimate coup. And the NEP, the New Economic Policy, was the means whereby this was going to be done. And this is where the profits were being made. In fact, the gold was pouring out of Russia. The Russian gold poured into the USA in such a flood, the bankers they didn't have time to certify it all. Because this is what the NEP was doing, buying things from abroad, creating a new market society, because Lenin needed capitalist corruption. All right. I got through about a tenth of what I wanted to get through here. So this is going to be part one. I'm going to finish the October Revolution next week. There's so much here about Lenin, the state, and revolution, his book, his understanding of what democratization means, people like Felix Dzerzhinsky and all these others. I'm just getting started here. But this is the introduction to what the October Revolution was. As always, I'm trying to pack in so much in such a short space, but I will do part two next week and flesh out some of this outline that I've already given you. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.